Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
I was going through these letters about Mozart's life. And one, for example, was left by a musician who was writing to Mozart's sister about some of his memories. And he recalls going over to Mozart's house to play with his father when Mozart is little. And Mozart's father was a musician, and a group of adult musicians go over, and little Mozart comes in and says, "I want to play second violin." And Mozart's father goes, "Get out of here. You haven't had any lessons. You can't, you don't know how to play violin." And Mozart starts crying. And so this, the letter writer says, "I'll go with, you know, with him in the other room and play with him so he'll stop crying." And father says, and Mozart's father says, "Fine, but just be quiet in there. You know, play low." And next thing you know, they start hearing the second violin part coming from the other room. So Mozart's father and the other adult musicians go in there, and they see Mozart playing with made-up fingering, by the way, like, because nobody's taught him, so he's able to play the part just with his own improvised fingering. And then this part, I quote from the letter writer verbatim, he says, "Little Wolfgang was emboldened by our applause to insist that he could also play the first violin." And then he goes on and does that too, even though he hadn't been taught. And this is when his father realizes there's something very unusual. So again, it wasn't quite the complete parent manufactured story that it's sometimes portrayed to be. There was something driven by, you know, internally from these kids. And so my feeling is, it seems to me that the best chance you would have of having someone like that is still exposing them broadly to things and seeing if something happens to light their fire in that way.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. David, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually came across your story by way of my little sister, who had actually read an article that you wrote in the New York Times about your new book, Range, why, you know, generalists thrive in a specialized world. And she said, "You should really talk to this guy. I think he'd have a lot to teach you, particularly because you're a creative." And so I went and looked at the article. I ordered the book immediately. And I thought, yes, this is absolutely a conversation we need to have. And I want to start with a question that I think is really fitting given the subject matter of this book. And that is, what did your parents do for a living? And how did that end up shaping the choices that you made with your own life and career?
My parents are the law firm of Epstein and Epstein. It's just them. And my father works particularly in mental health law, and my mother in elder law. And obviously, since old age and mental illness frequently overlap, they're often collaborating. How that sort of shaped my approach, you know, I would say, yeah, I think I still have extended family members who are waiting for me to go to law school and haven't given up yet. You know, I thought I was going to be in like a test pilot and then an astronaut when I was a teenager. And then I ended up majoring in geology and astronomy in college, you know, and I think there were still some holdouts like, you know, geological, astronomical law, that could be a growth area. but nobody put any pressure on me or anything like that. But, you know, I don't really know other than I guess I grew up not wanting to be a lawyer for no good reason. I mean, my parents, yeah, I guess it's like anything. You get older and you realize, you know, suddenly your parents are getting smarter, but really it's that you're getting more mature. And I don't really know how it shaped me. They didn't put much pressure on me at all. I mean, it is interesting that my father, you know, that particularly my father, but both my parents to some extent, more so my father for sure, it intersects with science, you know, psychology and medicine with his area of the law. And for me, I started training to be a scientist and got off that track. And now I sort of have this this merger of science and writing, you know, what some people call skill stacking, where it's like you're not going trying to be the very best at any one particular thing, but you can sort of merge different things that create your own unique ground. And I just certainly didn't consciously ever attempt to imitate that. So maybe we just have similar temperaments. But I think that's a commonality for sure. For sure. Yeah. You know, honestly, if there is one thing that I think I have really sort of picked up or accelerated an aspect of my personal development you know, related to my parents. So when I was living in a tent in the Arctic when I decided to become a writer.
I remember reading that in the book.
Yeah. And so, and one of my first job, my first sort of steady job, I started, I took like a night class in journalism and I started freelancing for a local neighborhood newspaper. And my first steady job was as the guy who starts at midnight and goes to the morning at the New York Daily News, you know, a New York, like hard news kind of tabloid. And that was, I applied for an internship and got rejected. And basically they sort of came back to me and ultimately said, you can hang on here if you're willing to start at midnight. And as you can imagine, nothing happy that's going in a New York City paper happens between midnight and 10 a.m. for the most part. But yeah, what I did realize, you know, and some people think that is, you know, like a useless job or a grimy thing to do. I sort of disagree. I mean, I tend to think the fact that we glorify reporters who document the deaths abroad when we're in foreign conflicts, but not the ones who are documenting them in our own streets. I mean, I took some pride in the fact that every person who died by violence would end up in the paper, every single one. You know, and sometimes you see trends, and I think that's important. But a lot of the job was approaching people who were in some of the most vulnerable moments of their life. And that's something I really took with me to throughout my writing career. As I approach people and I want to learn about their jobs or I want to learn about their stories, that you're often, you know, at one, whether it's right when you approach them or just something you get to talking about, is if they're really going to open up to you, they're exposing some vulnerability. And I think my parents, part of their job is dealing with people at the most vulnerable, often embarrassing moments of their lives, and doing that with an enormous amount of compassion and not bringing your own judgment to it. And I think sort of leaving your personal baggage behind and judgmental, you know, and any judgment behind when you approach people and want to talk about their stories is an important thing. And I think that's something that I sort of more consciously recognized as one of the tools that's very important to me in what I do.
Yeah. It's funny because I think you always look at things that your parents give you and recognize in retrospect their value while, you know, when they're happening, you're like, this is just a pain in the ass. Like, I think that Indian parents basically instilled discipline in us. It was like, you get straight A's. Like, that's all there is to this. And nobody puts your report cards on fridges. It was like, why the hell did you get a B minus? And, you know, and I think I've shared this story before with people who are listening that, you know, I remember the first time I came home and I brought this up to my dad is that, hey, this kid at school gets a $5 for every A. My dad said, yeah, you get a meal every night. So this negotiation is over. What I wonder, I think it's interesting that your parents, both being lawyers, didn't necessarily encourage any one particular career path, which to me explains, I think, a lot about the book itself. And, you know, it's funny because it's such a contrast from the environment that I grew up in as an Indian American. And most Indian Americans, probably, if you have any Indian friends, have probably told you this. It's like, yeah, you want a good life, become a doctor, lawyer, engineer. And that is kind of the narrative that is passed on to us over and over and over. So I wonder, you know, when you look at it that early in life, and, you know, I know this is largely what the book is about, but when you think about parents who have particularly young kids or you know, kids who are in high school, and just out of curiosity, are you a parent yourself? What kind of advice would you pass on to your own kids if you have children based on this perspective that you've developed as a byproduct of this book? And what would you tell parents who are listening about this?
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, I think some of it depends on the temperament of a kid. And there's actually a lot of interesting work about the difficulties sometimes parents face if their children have a different temperament than them. Like there's some research that shows that parents of adopted children will often bring them to a hospital for psychiatric care with a much lower level of symptoms than their biological children. And the suggestion is that it's because they just don't recognize the temperament as much. And so, you know, they're more prone to think that something is really wrong. And so I think some of it, you know, you have to judge the temperament. And for me, I think my parents probably realized that I was very hard on myself and I didn't really need, like, if I didn't get a good grade, I was going to intercept it on the way home and nobody was going to see it. So I really didn't need anybody, you know, and I think this is true of everything I've done. Like, I think about this in terms of when I was a college runner and in a training group. A good coach realizes that some people need to be managed in order to train more, because they won't do enough on their own. And other people need to be managed to train less because they'll go overboard on their own. And so I think some of it is keeping an eye on that temperament. And for me, it was, I didn't need to be pushed in that way. Sometimes I needed to be sort of pulled back a little bit. So maybe my parents were a little more like, you know, how I described Roger Federer's parents in the book as pulley instead of pushy. And I think I am a parent. By the way, you asked, I have a nearly 6 month old, who hopefully will not do anything too loud or else he'll be making an appearance on this podcast because he's
that's totally fine. Room. I don't think anybody will complain.
and I actually think of my role as a parent, and I'm wary of giving too much concrete advice. Like I know that in both of my books, people ask for a lot of advice and I sort of write about questions that really interest me and then hope that they, resonate with people in a way that they can think about how they fit into their life. Right. Cause this conversation of how broad or specialized to be, I think is one that is important to everyone at some point, either implicitly or explicitly at some point. Yeah. And I don't think anybody could offer a perfect answer to what an individual should do. But my hope is sort of those conversations usually take place purely in the realm of intuition. Can I bring some research to it to make those conversations more interesting and more productive? And that certainly happened for me in facing parenting. So the way I think of parenting now is sort of akin to something that I mention in the Trouble with Too Much Grit chapter. And I only mention it in brief, and I'm thinking about expanding it maybe when I add an afterword. But the Army's program called talent-based branching, and I know that sounds weird to start off with because I don't want to liken my parenting to, you know, the Army. But the talent-based branching program was created when the Army started realizing that in a knowledge economy where people who can engage in knowledge creation and problem solving have this incredible amount of lateral mobility and their highest potential future officers were leaving the Army in huge numbers. You know, first they tried to throw money at them and the people who were going to stay took it and the people who were going to leave anyway left. And that was $500 million of taxpayer money down the drain. Didn't change retention at all. And then they started programs like this one called talent-based branching, where instead of saying, here's your career track, go up or out, they'd say, here, we're going to pair you with a coach. Try this career track here and then reflect on how it fits your interests and abilities with your coach. You know, what economists call match quality. And then try this other one and this other one and these other two, and you'll keep zigzagging and we'll triangulate a better fit for you. And I sort of see my role, I sort of see my role as a parent as akin to the coach in the talent-based branching process, where early on to facilitate this diverse array of opportunities and then to help my son's reflection so that he gets the maximum amount of learning signal from each of those experiences. I think that's the role of the coach in talent-based branching. And I think that's an analogy to how I'm thinking about parenting at the moment.
Wow. It's funny because I think of a few different things when I hear you describe that. I don't have kids. So, you know, for me, it's all beautiful. I jokingly say like, you know, doing the Unmistakable Creative has also been like a lesson in parenting for, you know, the kids I'm going to have someday, hopefully. The thing that is interesting to me, and I wonder about this based on your perspective and the research that you've done is what role context and environment play. And let me give you, you know, a little bit more on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I, for a long time thought my parents' whole career advice of go do something stable was bullshit. And then I finally came to this sort of moment of empathy and realization that, wait a minute, you guys grew up in a life that was extremely binary, poverty or, you know, stability. Like there was nothing in between. So I wonder, you know, what role context and environment play in how people think about these things or the outcomes in people's lives when it comes to this whole idea of range.
Yeah, I think it plays an enormous role. And when you were saying that, one of the things that sort of popped into my head was this is only semi-related, but if you look at different countries, so if you look at like the World Health Organization's ranking of countries by gender equity, what you see is that the countries that have less freedom of choice for women, essentially, will see women concentrated in a much smaller number of careers, basically because the choice is, you know, you can work to survive and try to have a better life. And there are only a very limited number of jobs available where that really makes a lot of sense for women, where they really have opportunity. So they really cluster in them. And whereas in the countries where they have a lot more choice, you actually see this much, you know, greater diversity of women spread across different careers and sometimes clustering in different careers or changing careers and things like that. And it's just sort of, I think it's just kind of similar in the sense that when you're facing, essentially you have a limited number of options in a lot of contexts, and that's most people in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so the decision isn't really being made based on, okay, let's maximize your match quality, right? Again, this, mm-hmm. we know that finding a fit with your interests and abilities is really important for your ultimate performance, for your motivation, your resistance, right? As one of the researchers I quote in the book says, when you get fit, it'll look like grit, meaning that if you get people mm-hmm. in a good match, they'll display the characteristics of grit, like resilience and work ethic. But there are other ways to get that, right? And trying to stay out of poverty or improve your life, I think, can also be a significant motivating factor and make people more resilient. And those, some of those choices, I think, will overcome some of the other stuff like match quality or fulfillment or all those other things. And mm-hmm. so I think it's an incredibly context dependent for sure.
Yeah. So one thing, you mentioned that you had ran track, you gave us a little glimpse of one of the things that you learned, in terms of, coach having to hold you back. What else did you learn from being a runner that you have applied to being a writer, researcher, journalist? Like, what have you applied to your career going forward from the experience of being a runner?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For one, I wrote about this sort of in my first book that there's this incredible individual variability in response to particular training plans. And so when I went through a lot of the literature on skill acquisition, one of the things that surprised me is how different a response people will have to the same exact training. Mm-hmm. And so, like, one of the most famous exercise genetics study of all time basically put every member of two generations of 98 families on 6 months of identical cycling training, totally controlled in a lab. These were previously sedentary but healthy people, and they wanted to see how much people could improve what's called VO2 max, the amount of oxygen they can move through their blood when they're going as hard as they can. And the variation in improvement between people was, more than tenfold. On identical training. And of course, identical twins were about nine times more similar than fraternal twins. But even maybe even more interesting than that, the correlation between ability at baseline, so this VO2 max, again, your aerobic capacity is sort of shorthand, the correlation between ability at baseline and ability to improve was zero. So on day one of the study, they did a baseline test and say, okay, here are 10 most talented people. Miss 100% of the people who end the study looking the most talented, despite the fact that everyone did the exact same thing, right? So, and that's like the trend in that sort of literature where, I think there's a reason why people can do the same diet or the same training and they get very different results. And so before I got into that science, I was kind of attuned to that because, being in different training groups and noticing everyone doing the same things and often getting more different, not more the same. And so I think that attuned me to the fact that I need to kind of put in some personal experimentation to find what's the best training environment for me. And I'm pretty confident mm-hmm. that it's never the first one I start with, because that would just be luck, right? That I go into whatever it is with this sort of trial and error mindset trying to sort of customize the training environment to me. And that's like, and there's something, can I give another point about running?
Please, yes, absolutely.
There's something I learned that from running that doesn't work for me in the wider world, which is, I had a goal book when I was running, and you put your running goals and training and all those things. And I transitioned that to my, work life when I was done running. And I actually found it was not nearly as useful, because the goals in track and field are very black and white. And mm-hmm. that's not the case in the rest of the world. And it's not as clear, exactly when you're making progress. You can't time everything every day based on like a stopwatch. And so eventually I got rid of that and realized it didn't work. And in the reporting of range, something in Herminia Ibarra, the woman who studies like kind of how people find match quality in work and how people make successful and unsuccessful career transitions. And she had this phrase that really stuck in my head: we learn who we are in practice, not in theory. And what she meant is that there's this whole like industry of personality quizzes and career gurus who give the idea that you can just introspect and know what you should be doing. When in fact, all the evidence suggests that you actually have to do stuff and reflect on it. And that's how you learn about yourself, which is why when we're younger, we don't exactly know everything about ourselves. You have to learn about yourself in practice. And so having dispensed with sort of the running goal book for my work life a long time ago, more recently I picked up what I call my book of small experiments, where at least every other month I have to you know, I'll put in a hypothesis basically about something I want to learn about or some skill I want to try to improve. And then I'll find some way to engage in experiments. Sometimes it can be very small and sometimes bigger. And then I'll come back and reflect on how that worked. And just having that forces me to kind of get out of my rut of competence, you know, my inertia of what I'm usually doing. And in the writing, one of those experiments in the writing of Range involved taking an online beginner's online fiction writing class. And it turned out to pay like huge dividends for my writing. I went back to my whole manuscript and changed all this stuff basically. But so one of the things I learned in running was that the same sort of goal setting actually didn't work well for me. And I've come around to sort of very different approach to that.
It's funny because I when you say that, I can't help but think about how, you know, two parents could raise two sets of kids with exactly the same sort of situation. I mean, my sister and I are like, you know, both byproducts of the exact same upbringing with wildly different results based on the guidance our parents gave us.
Yeah.
So that's what I think of right when you say that. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that really struck me is, you know, you opened the book early on by saying eventual elites devote less time early on to deliberate practice in the activity in which they will eventually become experts. Instead, they undergo what researchers call a sampling period. They play a variety of sports, usually in an unstructured or lightly structured environment. They gain a range of physical proficiencies from which they can draw. They learn about their own abilities and proclivities, and only later do they focus in and ramp up technical practice in one area. And it, you know, now that I'm talking with you about this, it just kind of hit me. And I even wrote about this in my own book where I said, you know, like probably the greatest influence on my life as a creative was that I played the tuba for 9 years. And I'm not a professional tuba player, but the translation that came from that was discipline and practice to get, you know, better at something that I had no natural aptitude for. But I think that the thing that is fascinating to me about this, and I think where I want to start is by talking particularly about education, because I know you alluded to it, you quoted research in it. You know, you go to college, I mean, even parental advice, you know, I still to this day will never forget the conversation my dad was having with one of my uncles about his son. And he said, you know, what does he want to do? Does he want to study computers, become a doctor and engineer? I was like, wait a minute, this kid is like 15 years old. You've limited his whole future to four possible outcomes already. And so, you know, the thing is that you've written about Range, yet the entire system is designed in such a way not to help us cultivate Range. Like you go to college, and I think it's borderline insanity to ask 18-year-olds to figure out what they want to do with their life because they don't have enough data points. Like you said, it's practice. I didn't know that I wanted to do this as a writer or interview people. I just did it a lot. And I realized it was that I found it engaging. And that's what drew me to it. So I wonder, you know, how you, and particularly in the wake of this book, the college admission scandal and the rising cost of tuition, how you think about that quote that I just read from your book.
Yeah. I mean, that college admission scandal, first thing, by the way, the only way that I can make sense of that scandal, because I didn't, you know, I just followed it sort of in the news, no closer than the next guy.
Yeah.
But like, it seems some of those kids didn't even really want to go to college or at least, you know, one or two of them. The only way I can make sense of that scandal is if those kids were basically like pieces of jewelry for their parents, right? They wanted to show them off because it didn't seem like they were trying to do it in the best interest of the kids, right? So that's I don't know. I can't, that's the only way I can make sense of that. But in terms of, in terms of sort of the education system, you know, not cultivating range in people. I mean, the education system before pre-college, our education system is still very much based on tenets that came out of Taylorism, you know, the basically science of efficient management, which was great for an industrial economy where you were churning out people for jobs that are, you know, what I use the coinage of the psychologist Robin Hogarth in the book, kind learning environments, where people will be facing this similar task where work next year will look like work last year. And so sort of doing repetitive things is and having basic competencies is really important. But that's not the life, you know, that's not the world that we work in anymore. And I think the education system is like a big oil tanker. It takes, you know, you got to start steering 40 miles out from shore to get it docked right. And so I think some things are starting to change. And in fact, there's no question if you look at proficiency exams that kids today have better mastery of basic skills than their parents did. No question. It's just the challenge has become so much harder, like so much more conceptual and abstract thought is required in modern work. So going forward to higher ed, which you mentioned, I think there are two main issues here, main problems. First is what I write about in Range called the end of history illusion. This psychological finding that at every time point in life, we will all recognize that we have changed a lot in the past based on our experiences, and then say, but now I'm pretty much done. And at every time point in life, we'll say that, and we will be wrong. We will underestimate future change at every time point, even when we're very old. But at no time is that more true than from about 18 to the late 20s. That's when you undergo mm-hmm. the fastest time of personality yeah. change. And so essentially, right at the start of that period, we're telling someone, pick now, which is really asking them to pick for a person they don't yet know, mm-hmm. and certainly in a world they can't yet conceive, unless they have a crystal ball that most people don't. Yeah. And so I think it's a particularly bad time to make ironclad long-term plans, and we should be much more oriented toward pick something, you know, and I'm sort of stealing this idea from the economist and statistician Robert Miller, we should orient people toward do the thing that's going to give you a high information signal about whether it fits you or not. Those are the things you should dive into first, yeah. where you can get high information signal. And if we look at, and so sort of go to the other prong that's kind of related to that, the question you asked and that I was curious about is sort of addressed by this economist Ofer Malamud, whose work I write about. When he was wondering about specialization timing in higher education, and he found a sort of natural experiment in the higher ed systems of England and Scotland. And basically the systems in the period he studied were very similar, but the English students had to specialize earlier. They had to pick, like, when they were about 16 or so, what specific program of study they wanted to try to test into for university. And the Scottish students they didn't have to do that. They could sample for the first couple of years of college. They could continue taking different classes outside of any sort of focus, even late into their education. And his question was, who wins the trade-off? The early or late specializers in these otherwise very similar populations and similar systems. And what he found was that the early specializers do in fact jump out to an income lead because they have more domain-specific skills. So not a huge surprise. But the late specializers, because of their sampling, they end up having higher match quality. First of all, they pick better fits for themselves. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before, giving someone only four options, they're much more likely to end up studying things they hadn't heard of when they got into college, much more likely. Yeah. And so they end up with higher growth rates. And by 6 years out, they shoot past the early specializers. And then the early specializers end up quitting their entire sort of career fields in much greater numbers. Uh-huh. Essentially because they were made to pick so early that they made more mistakes. And when they do that, though, they then have higher growth rates. So it's good for them to do it. Uh-huh. But, you know, they have more disincentive from doing it because they've put a lot of time in. So in the long term, the people who have a little time to sample, the later specializers, win the mm-hmm. trade-off. And I think that sort of encapsulates, to me, what was really one of the themes of the book, which is sometimes the things you can do to get a short-term advantage undermine your long-term development.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind.
Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's funny, you may have heard of this book. We had Rich Karlgaard here, who wrote a book called Late Bloomers, right? It's funny because I think what I like about your way of explaining this is that you backed it up with a lot of research. I mean, he also backed it up with, I felt like his story was much more anecdotal, whereas yours has got a lot more science behind it. Both phenomenal books, like with really interesting ideas. One thing that, I wondered based on that alone, there's one other thing in here that you said. You said if the amount of early specialized practice in an area were the key to innovative performance, savants would dominate every domain they touched, and child prodigies would always go on to adult eminence. We've had Anders Ericsson here, based on having read this book, I know you're familiar with his work. Mm-hmm. And what that made me wonder is, why do you get some people who actually do figure it out early on? I think my sister to me is always like a perfect example. And I think the challenge is, particularly with med school, is you kind of have to know fairly early whether you're going to go or not. And that's one of those things that I couldn't help but wonder, why is it that so many people, I can tell you that I did nothing of significance until after I became 30. Mm-hmm. The first 10 years of my career were a disaster.
And by the way, speaking of Anderson's work, I took his work on much more directly in my first book, and I know him and things like that. But I should say in his book Peak, there's a little mention where he says this deliberate practice framework, early specialization and 10,000 hours and all that, although I know he doesn't like the 10,000 hour rule as a moniker. There's basically a little part in the book where he says, by the way, this stuff applies to very well-defined fields where we know all the tenets of excellence and where you can get a coach who can tell you exactly what you have to do. And I'm like, that to me is like the loophole that becomes
everybody
book,
overlooked.
Basically.
Yeah.
So what he's saying is this kind of stuff works in kind learning environments. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I don't know what causes some people to figure it out. Ellen Winner, who I think is one of the most interesting people who studies this, would be a fascinating person for you to talk to. She studies prodigies, essentially. Mm-hmm. And
definitely, I'll have to add her to my list.
Yeah, she has a cool book about myths and realities of gifted children. And when she's talking about gifted children, it's usually people who are at an adult level of performance when they're, before age 10 or something like that. Yeah. And one thing she identifies in them is this sort of rage to master, right? And they'll have an ability in a particular area that tends to really outstrip their abilities in other areas. In many cases, but not in all cases. I mean, they are often quite bright in a number of things, but there's some one thing that sort of lights their fire like nothing else does. And I don't know that anybody knows exactly why that is. And I think that even shows up this is a little bit of an aside, but I think it's an important note that I wish I had actually included in the book and I stupidly cut. But again, maybe for the afterword, I'm going to have a 30,000 word afterword for them.
Or another book.
Yeah. Oh, goodness, no. I need, after both books, I've said no more books, never again. It just takes a period of recovery. But the Tiger Woods story, I think we tell a little bit of it wrong. So Tiger in 2000 said that his father never once asked him to play golf. It was always him asking his father, and that it's the child's interest in playing, not the father's interest. So his father facilitated and cultivated an enormous amount of deliberate practice. But he was at first responding to, I mean, he had been a baseball player. He was responding to Tiger's very unusual display of interest and prowess. And I think Tiger's is probably the most powerful modern development story that exists. So I think that's an important one to know. The second most popular, I would say, is probably Mozart. And again, I was going through these letters about Mozart's life. And one, for example, was left by a musician who was writing to Mozart's sister about some of his memories. And he recalls going over to Mozart's house to play with his father when Mozart is little. And Mozart's father was a musician, and a group of adult musicians go over, and little Mozart comes in and says, "I want to play second violin." And Mozart's father goes, "Get out of here. You haven't had any lessons. You don't know how to play violin." And Mozart starts crying. And so the letter writer says, "I'll go in with him in the other room and play with him so he'll stop crying." And Mozart's father says, "Fine, but just be quiet in there. You know, play low." And next thing you know, they start hearing the second violin part coming from the other room. So Mozart's father and the other adult musicians go in there and they see Mozart playing with made up fingering, by the way, like, because nobody's taught him. So he's able to play the part just with his own improvised fingering. And then this part, I quote from the letter writer verbatim. He says, "Little Wolfgang was emboldened by our applause to insist that he could also play the first violin." And then he goes on and does that too, even though he hadn't been taught. And this is when his father realizes there's something very unusual. So again, it wasn't quite the complete parent manufactured story that it's sometimes portrayed to be. There was something driven by, internally from these kids. And so my feeling is, those kinds of stories, Tiger and Mozart, incredibly rare, no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that the best chance you would have of having someone like that is still exposing them broadly to things and seeing if something happens to light their fire in that way.
Yeah.
What it is exactly that causes that sort of thing, I'm not sure anybody knows.
I think that's been the quest that I've been on for 10 years. Simon Sinek said to me once, he said, "Your why is that you're obsessed with people who are good at unusual things," which explains the fact that we've had bank robbers and drug dealers as our guests on the podcast, along with people like you. It's funny that you say that, because I think about this moment that I had with my seventh grade band director, who basically, I wanted to switch instruments from the trombone, and he said, "Well, you can switch to the tuba." And it meant getting out of football practice. And he basically, I don't know what it was, the day I picked up the instrument, he said, "You're going to make All-State band." And when he told me that, it was this sort of moment of, I know I will always be an average athlete, but you're telling me I could be somebody as good enough to be the best in the state at this? That, I don't know what it did. It lit a fire under my ass. Like, and up until that point, I remember even going back to see my sixth grade band director when I went to do a concerto at a school in ninth grade. And I still remember this moment from sixth grade band, because nothing about this would indicate that I would show up as the kid who would eventually make All-State band. Because I remember he calls on me and he says, "What are the flags on the notes for?" And I raise my hand and I say, "Well, they're for decoration." And it was just one of those things where I always think that, the teacher played such a big role in that.
I mean, that's interesting you mentioned that. And since I have like a weird semantic network in my brain, you had mentioned drug dealers just before this.
Yeah.
And that made me think of when I left, in the interest of expanding my own range, I do things that my agent like tells me are ridiculous. Like, as soon as my first book came out, it was about genetics and sports. And I was a writer at Sports Illustrated at the time. I then left right when it came out and went to this startup called ProPublica, a startup at the time, that does investigative work, and spent a year reporting about drug cartels or even more so about some of the deals our government gets involved in the pursuit of drug cartels. But one of the things that occurred to me while I was doing this reporting and meeting people who were in cartels was that some of these young guys who are ambitious but going nowhere, someone from a cartel comes to them and essentially gives them a vision of themselves that nobody else around them did and that they themselves hadn't even imagined. And it becomes kind of intoxicating and propels them to do things that are incredibly courageous and dangerous. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that energy is directed in a very counterproductive direction for society as a whole. Right. But it was very interesting to me, the sort of the ways by which they were motivated. And I think one of the main, you know, of course they wanted money, but I think mm-hmm. a main driver was in recruitment was often someone coming to these young people and giving them this vision of themselves that they hadn't even imagined it, that nobody else had. And that would engage them in a way that they hadn't been engaged before. And one would wish that that could happen in a more productive manner. But I do think that there was a commonality of theme there.
Yeah. Well, I remember, it's funny because I remember The Sports Gene being on my list of things to read. And I don't know why I never got to it, but I'm going to definitely get it now. And so I think that, you know, the question that comes from that is, when you studied athletes, what parts of range did you see in professional athletes, like people who get to the level of sort of NBA basketball player? The other thing that I wonder, this is just a morbid, you know, weird personal curiosity question. So I'm a weirdo who doesn't actually watch sports, but I play sports video games religiously. Like I play NBA 2K19 every day. And the thing that I've always been baffled by, and maybe you can explain this to me, is how can somebody be so good that they get to the NBA, but they suck at shooting free throws?
That's a great question. And I did some data analysis stuff for my first book, some of which made it in and some of which didn't. And here's one that didn't. I was curious if players in the NBA would get better at free throw shooting over the course of their NBA career, right? Mm-hmm. Was this like, were they finished products as far as how good they were shooting, you know, they were shooting by the time they got to the NBA or did they improve? And the fact was that if you took a huge number of players, obviously some players actually managed to get worse, but if you looked at a huge number of players, definitively they get better over their career at free throw shooting, which suggests to me that like you're going to get better just by doing it, right? That's a pretty simple non-dynamic task. So they're clearly not doing enough of it.
Right.
And I don't think they're being very thoughtful about it either, right? Like, you know, my first debate partner and then running partner, Malcolm Gladwell, did a podcast about how a lot of basketball players should be shooting underhanded free throws, you know, Rick Barry style.
Yeah.
And none of them will do it because it seems stupid.
Because you're shooting the granny shot.
Like literally nobody in college or the pros. Like how is it that there's that much social pressure not to do it that, you know, people who are shooting 40s, 50s% free throws who would score 10, you know, more points a game, like some of the bigger players won't give it a try. So I don't know. Let me tell you my perception about the NBA from having actually been around some teams and things like that when I was at SI and still sometimes now is that there's so few players in the NBA and the players are so highly skilled that the NBA more than other leagues has this sort of feeling of everyone is kind of like, don't break anything. Like all the strength and conditioning people, the coaches, it's very much don't break anything. And I think the sports scientists and physiologists and things who work in the NBA recognize that most players will not develop to their fullest potential in the NBA because there's such so much emphasis on don't break anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a real part of why you don't see as much improvement as you can. And who am I to say maybe that's the right trade-off, right? Because there are so few players. But you know, in most sports, you think of the way that we're going to make this person more injury resistant is to work them hard in certain ways, not to not work them hard at all. But you know, so I think it's a mix. But I think a lot of players don't get as good as they could, don't see as much improvement as they could in the NBA because there really is that theme of like everybody.
Just for me, like I said, the thing that baffles me is that wait a minute, you're good enough to play at this level, and this seems like an aspect of the game that is like simple in comparison to everything else that you have to do. And part of me wonders, does it, you know, speaking of range, is it just something that gets neglected because they're so good at one aspect of the game? And you know, what did you notice about this idea of range in people who become professional athletes? Because I remember, I don't know either whether it was playing the game or whatever it was, that LeBron was recruited for both football and basketball.
I mean, it's almost all of the athletes who go on to become elite were multi-sport athletes, basically. Yeah. And even if they didn't play those sports formally, they engaged in a lot of unstructured play in other sports. And I think the people who you do see continuing to improve at the elite level. So let's say when I first wrote about this trend in sports, this happened when I got, so I criticized some of a little bit of Malcolm Gladwell's writing in my first book, just in like a couple pages, but it became the thing that everyone fixated on. And I don't mean that as criticism. It's just, that's what happened. And so we were invited to the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference to have a debate, which is on YouTube, back in, I guess this would have been 2014. That conference was founded by the general manager of the Rockets, Houston Rockets, co-founded. And we were there, invited there to debate athletic development. And I had seen he'd written about the importance, you know, primary importance of early head start and technical practice. So I was a science writer at Sports Illustrated at the time. So I said, well, if that's the hypothesis, let's go look at the data. And I saw in almost every sport, you actually see the athletes who go on to become elite have this sampling period where they learn those broad skills. They learn about their interests and abilities, and they systematically delay specializing until later than their peers. They have higher amounts of unstructured play. And so when we came off the stage, he was sort of like, you know, what you got me on was that thing. That didn't really comport with my hypothesis. You should write more about that. And so that sort of stuck in my head, but that's the trend, but we never hear that, right? We hear the Tiger Woods story, even though it's the vast exception. And even though golf is kind of a bad model of most other things that people want to learn. And I think the players who go on to improve as pros are these, you know, more like the Steph Curry mold, where you still, he was a multi-sport athlete and you still see him doing stuff, embracing, you know, I think he's just doing it intuitively or for fun or whatever, but what scientists would call variable practice, where he's shooting from all these weird spaces and all these weird angles. And if you see him doing his warm up, right, he's like throwing one-handed shots and he's kicking shots sometimes. And that, if you like the best principles of motor control, so Robert Bjork, who is a psychologist who coined the phrase desirable difficulties, which refers to training and learning techniques that slow you down in the short term, make things harder and more frustrating, but end up with more long-term benefit. He actually said what Shaquille O'Neal should have been doing is not continuing to try like shooting with one hand or the other hand from 15 feet. He should have been shooting from 14 and 16 and 17 and 13, because his problem was motor modulation, essentially. And you learn that from variable practice as opposed to just banging your head against the same thing over and over and over. And so I think some of the guys that improve, they continue to work in that variable practice that they used to get from unstructured play when they were younger, but that you can lose when you're at the top level because, you know, there's an urgency for running the plays and things like that.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because there's this other quote you put in your book, and now that we're having this conversation, something just clicked in my head. You said the more context in which something is learned, the more the learned creates abstract models, and the less they rely on a particular example, learners become better at applying their knowledge to a situation they've never seen before, which is the essence of creativity. And the thing that this made me think of is, I tried to learn how to snowboard when I was in my early 20s, and it just, you know, after I think two seasons, I concluded this is bullshit. Brown people in cold weather are not meant to be. To hell with this. Then I became a surfer, and after about 5 years of surfing, we had a bad surf season here in Southern California, and I was losing my mind. If you know anything about surfers, we're not happy people when we're not in the water consistently. And I was like, damn it, I need something to do. And in my mind, I thought, you know what, I'm going to go back to the mountain and give snowboarding another try. And it clicked like that. And, you know, I mean, I think in the last 2-3 years, I got to the point where I was doing black diamonds. And I mean, I remember even 2 years ago, I was like, oh, I would never be able to do a black diamond. But it seems like a lot of the skills from surfing translated. So I wonder, is that an example of what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good example of transfer. Transfer being the term psychologists use for your ability to take skills or knowledge from one area and apply them to an area that you have, or an area or a problem that you, there's my 6-month-old. I don't know if you can hear him, but,
no worries.
And can you hear him on your side?
I can't actually.
Oh, okay, great. and apply them to either situations or problems that you haven't seen before. And I think the finding to keep in mind, it's not a single finding, but sort of a summary of an area of research. And again, I'm taking this from a researcher named Deidre Gentner, so I don't want to claim this is my insight, but is breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. So your ability to take those skills and knowledge and apply them to something you haven't seen before is predicted by how broad your training was. And so I think mixing in these different types of motor skills and perceptual skills and things like that really prime you to then be able to learn much faster when you make like a lateral movement to another area. So that doesn't really surprise me. It also makes you less fragile, by the way. Yet another thing that I cut that maybe will end up in the afterword was I spent some time with Cirque du Soleil's physiologist. Mm-hmm. They have an incredible amount of physiology data because, you know, they have a lot of former Olympic athletes and they have so many shows and they're all wearing like biometric vests and everything. Mm-hmm. And they decided, looking at some of this research about multi-sport, which I think multiple sports is really just a proxy for movement diversity. It doesn't matter that you're like putting on a jersey of some other sport, but they decided to have their performers learn the basics of like three other performers' disciplines. And you know, they have to think it's pretty serious to do that, to take away time from these performers training in their main discipline. And they track their injury rates against Canadian Gymnastics. It's a Canadian company. And they found it reduced their injury rates by like 30%. They felt subjectively that it made some of the performers more creative, sort of dabbling in these other disciplines for designing their own performances. But objectively, it lowered their injury rates like 30%. There's something that makes people more anti-fragile about diversifying their movement. And we can speculate about what that is, but I bet my guess is that some of it has to do with mixing and practice variability that improves your perceptual expertise and your learning. And it's just like a classic breadth of training predicts breadth of transfer. When you incorporate some variable practice, it makes you better at everything.
Yeah. So I want to talk about how this transfers to knowledge work, because we've been talking about it in the context of athletes, and probably not everybody who's listening to this is an athlete, but there's something you said in the book that also struck me as really interesting. You said struggling to generate an answer on your own, even a wrong one, enhances subsequent learning. Socrates was apparently onto something when he forced people to generate answers rather than bestowing them. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, yet we have an education system that really, at the end of the day, punishes people for being wrong, because over time, you sort of get trained to be compliant instead of curious. And so I wonder, you know, how do you navigate that? And then, you know, how do we take these concepts of sort of developing range if you're, say, somebody like me who is a knowledge worker? Granted, I can tell you that without a question, you know, surfing and snowboarding influence my writing. I don't think it's a coincidence that those two things are parallel to the day, because I think the habits and sort of discipline that came out of surfing is very much parallel to how I write every day.
Well, I mean, you were also saying, you know, you were mentioning the breadth of sort of the backgrounds of the guests you've had.
Yeah.
Also, which I'm sure interacting with these people. You know, one thing I tell people who don't have much time and they want to, you know, I say, well, how can I learn about other jobs that might be interesting to me? I'm like, every time you bump into someone who has a job that you're not familiar with, ask them questions as if you had to write a report the next day about their job, and you'll ask at a different level. I mean, you're doing that for your podcast, you know, at an even deeper level. So I'm sure that's a massive way of—
Well, 700 interviews would probably— I always wished that I wish I could figure out how to do something like a brain study to look at what my brain looked like 10 years ago prior to this project and what it looks like now.
It looked horrible. Now it looks great.
I think that's probably fair to say.
No, but I mean, but that really is, right? Being interested in a lot of things is a great way to expand your range. And like you said, people do get— you mentioned compliance being more important than some of the things that might actually be more helpful. Mm-hmm. I was just looking at a study by some economist that was looking at personality traits and grades and work, and some of the personality traits were negatively correlated with grades but positively correlated with income, which tells you that your system's not ideal. You know, there were also traits that were positively correlated with grades and positively correlated with income, but ideally you'd get all those things running in the right direction, right? Or you would sort of diversify the development pipeline enough that it could fit people with, you know, that it would be less coming out of Taylorism where everyone's kind of getting stamped in the same way off the assembly line. And so I think we should build in more flexibility to how we develop people. And in fact, to use a sports analogy, that's been a huge part of the successful turnarounds that like Australian national sport had and British national sport. So in the lead up to the London Olympics, they, you know, had a woman, this brilliant woman named Chelsea Waar, who's actually Australian, come over to England and help them like improve their development pipelines, because they had been doing like very mediocre in Olympics for a long time. And, you know, with her home Olympics coming up, wanted to do better. And one of the main things she did was diversify the pipelines by which they recruited and developed. She said, right now, we're only getting what she called the fast risers, like the people who show a lot of prowess pretty early.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're easy to identify. And actually, it's often the case that it's just that they go through puberty earlier and they get identified for that reason, as opposed to actually having the highest potential. And in fact, people that go through puberty later are more likely to be taller. So like selecting against that is, you know, like Giannis in the NBA, right? He went through puberty basically after he got drafted. And so it's a late one, you know, and he grew a lot. But so she said the fast risers were okay with. Like everybody, those people are easy to see.
Yeah.
It's the slow bakers, as she called them, that's where you have the advantage. That if you can diversify your pipeline so that you're not like deselecting people based on your cookie cutter model, you allow people to sort of find their path a little more and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And they had, I mean, most of their the impact that they had enormous improvement in medals and all these things, and a huge amount of it came from diversifying their pipelines that allowed these slow bakers to come through. And you know, and some of them, one of them I think is this rower who's arguably the most dominant athlete in the world, and she had not even rowed at the previous Olympics. I think she's like been, I don't think she's lost in like 6 years anyway. This woman named Helen Glover, but last I checked. But so I think that's a good model for a lot of things we do. And it's, you know, it's a little bit akin again to that talent-based branching, but it's basically just diversifying so that you're not, if someone wants to focus in really early and that's, they're driven that way and they're a Tiger or Mozart, like I'm not going to tell them. I don't want to prescribe diversification any more than I want to prescribe specialization. Right. Mm-hmm. But I do think we should diversify the pipeline because we know it fits a certain kind of person and that's great for them. But a lot of people aren't that type.
Yeah, it's funny. It makes me think of something that Robert Greene said to me right after he wrote Mastery. We had him here and he said, you know, the analogy is biodiversity. He said, the more species you have in an ecosystem, the richer that ecosystem is. And he said, no experience in your life should be thought of as wasted. And I think that really struck me because I remember that. And you even say, you echo this sentiment in your book where you say the labs in which scientists had more diverse professional backgrounds were the ones where more and more varied analogies were offered, where breakthroughs were more reliably produced than when the unexpected arose. And it's funny because, you know, this story I may have shared before, and you may have heard it. There's a Google story about this, you know, longstanding policy that for their associate product manager position, you had to be a computer science, like you had to have a computer science degree. And a young Stanford grad who didn't have a computer science degree goes to his boss and says, hey, I want to apply for the program. Can you make an exception? Of course, as you might imagine, they move it up the chain. They say, no, we're not going to make an exception. That guy leaves. And his name was Kevin Systrom. So Google then changes the policy after that. But you know, I think this makes a perfect segue to kind of, you know, come to where I think I want to start wrapping up the conversation. But you talk about two things, which are the outsider advantage, and lateral thinking. And the reason I thought of this is because, you know, we'd been looking for a community manager to grow our show. And a bunch of people came in who had like social media backgrounds, copywriting backgrounds. And I remembered one of our listeners who was like a super, super fan, who'd been a very active participant. And I sent her a message on Facebook and she's like, Shreya, I don't have a background in this. She's like, I'm a civil engineer by trade and I do research and I have a PhD. And I said, I think you'll probably be the perfect person for this because what that tells me is that you know how to solve problems.
Yeah. And I mean, that's right. You know, and I think I was just looking at some LinkedIn research recently on 500,000 members, you know, because they have these great databases, so they can do much bigger studies than other people. And it found that one of the most important predictors for who would go on to become an executive was the number of different job functions someone had worked across. Mm-hmm. But we don't tell people like, go change a bunch of jobs. I mean, except for LinkedIn's chief economist, his main recommendation out of this research was if you want to be an executive, work across a lot of job functions. But you don't usually hear advice like that, right?
Yeah.
And I actually think that LinkedIn in some ways unintentionally can contribute to the problem a little bit. And let me give you an example of what I mean where, so I write a little bit in the book about how the Pat Tillman Foundation was part of the inspiration for writing the book, where the Pat Tillman Foundation, you know, named after the late NFL player who left mid-career to become an Army Ranger and was killed in Afghanistan. It gives scholarships to military spouses and veterans for career changes, essentially, to aid career changes. And I'm on the final selection committee now for this. I've gotten like more involved with the foundation every year. And it's like the final selection committee is like five civilians and five military. or ex-military or current. And first, when we go through these applications, you see what can often look like a sort of disjointed resume a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like some of the people, a lot of the people didn't go right to the military. So they did something and then they leave and go to the military and then they get out and do something totally different. And I can see, like, if you look at their, you know, what is essentially their LinkedIn, just the resume, it's hard to find a path. Like, what exactly are they doing, right? It seems like they've just been flitting from one thing to another. And then you go and get down to their essays, and it'll be like, you know, something happened and I saw a need, so I joined the military. And then when I was out in the most remote part of the Afghan, you know, mountains, translating for people who were in conflict and trying to keep them from killing each other, I realized that there's a huge lack of this certain type of communication in rural areas, and that created this new mission for me. So I decided to go, you know, and it'll, their narratives will tie all this stuff together, where you see it really is a progression of personal growth. Mm-hmm. In that, far from flitting among, you know, ideas, which I don't have a problem with anyway, they are adjusting to having learned things from these incredibly profound experiences and saying, this is how I recognized a need and also recognized something I'm good at that I didn't know before. Uh-huh. And so once you read those essays, you see, okay, these people are much more responsive to the lessons that the world is teaching them than is someone who's just like climbing the linear path.
Yeah.
But when you just look at the resume, you don't see that. And so I wish we could have like a LinkedIn that had sort of a better way to have that, the narrative of personal growth, because it ultimately ends up being much more impressive. And you see that they have much more unique skills and a totally different view that most of their peers do not have. And they will often be a little bit older than, you know, their peers, but they tend to then move very fast once they get in because they have this kind of diverse problem solving skills. You know, I mean, I remember being at dinner with a group of these Doman scholars, and there's like, you know, an ex Navy SEAL who's worried about being behind. I remember one of the guys who was worried about being all behind is an astronaut now, so he's okay. And that was only a couple of years ago.
Wow.
But they're told, you know, like, okay, you're late. Everyone's younger than you. You don't have sort of the linear experience. But that's because they're doing what I think is much more productive, which is that they are recognizing the lessons about themselves and the lessons about the world, and finding more profound and fitting goals for themselves through that journey. Yeah. Whereas I think it would not make sense if they did those things and then said, well, I'm just going to kind of ignore those lessons and just like keep forging ahead.
It's funny, as you're saying that, I can't help but think that the one, now I want to write a blog post about this, that, you know, the one common thread I know exists between every single person I've interviewed is that the path to where they're at was never linear, not once. And that's that. And it, you know, it's funny because that I think is half the battle of going out and doing, you know, something entrepreneurial, or trying your own thing. And, you know, like I realize even now, you know, I graduated from business school 10 years ago. I realize, and I, you know, for a while I thought I was terrified I'll never be able to get a job if it comes down to it. And I realize I am way more valuable now just due to the diversity of experiences I've had than I ever would have been with just that degree.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's really interesting to hear. I mean, I that resonates with me a lot, right? When I was leaving the training to be a scientist, basically my feeling was, well, that's a loss, you know, and then I end up as a temp fact checker at Sports Illustrated, and I'm 6 years older than the people I'm doing fact checking for. So yeah, I'm behind by any measure. But suddenly I realized what I would call my rather ordinary science skills were totally extraordinary in the context of a sports magazine. And I go from temp fact checker to the youngest senior writer there, like very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it was completely that uniqueness, whereas people who'd sort of more linearly climbed the ladder had to keep trying to linearly climb the ladder because they didn't have access to the kind of shortcut that I did, basically.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like you and I could talk all day about this. It seems like a really, really deep rabbit hole.
Yeah. No, I really enjoy this conversation and different than the ones I've been having for sure.
Yeah. Well, people, I have a feeling people tend to say that. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is? The big somebody or something unmistakable?
Wait, sorry. Say that again.
What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, that's really interesting. That makes somebody or something unmistakable. You know, I have this phrase from a philosopher I love named Bernard Suits. And he, in this brilliant work he wrote called The Grasshopper, he was trying to define the essence of games and sports and things like that. And previous philosophers had said there is no one thing that ties them all together. And Suits says, no, you're wrong. It's the voluntary acceptance of unnecessary obstacles. And I love that phrase just as an approach in general, right? Like, I don't ever want to feel comfortable with what I'm doing. I want to continue to voluntarily accept unnecessary obstacles. And sometimes when I meet people, I try to understand, you know, what unnecessary obstacles they have voluntarily accepted. And I tend to think that that is, when you get to that, it's an unmistakable differentiator of a lot of people if they've voluntarily accepted interesting, unnecessary obstacles.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your insights, and all of this with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the books, and everything else that you're up to?
DavidEpstein.com, and I'm at David Epstein on Twitter.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com /4keys and download your free copy